you know, call it what you will. And if you told me 2 years ago that I'd be standing up here meandering my way through some thoughts about our second group anniversary, I would have been very, very surprised. No more surprised than my fellow group members. This started out kind of very, very fragmented. About 3 years ago, there was a buzz going around about starting a new meeting, finding different meetings, not lacking, but yet not filling at the same time. And I heard Maggie was interested in starting a meeting. There was a buzz going around Westfield. People said, give Walt a call. And people were putting their heads together. Now, out here in Union, Anthony was interested in starting a meeting, and he came into contact with Peter Rem, who had relocated from Brooklyn, from Staten Island, and he was over here, and he was also looking for a place to hang his hat. And we would gather at Van Gozier Coffee House in Union over there, and we would try to hammer out this format. And what results, what you see tonight, is probably nothing like we intended. But we certainly got what we deserved. What we got is a meeting, you know, and it's 2 years to the day later, and the lights are on, and the coffee's on, and we got a speaker, and the door's open, and that's about all you can hope for in this day and age. And I'm real, real proud to be a group member here, and I'm thrilled to be a part of this process. It's one of the most daunting things I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was one of the most exhilarating things I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. We would come together, we had strong opinions, we had no opinions, we had strong no opinions, heads would bash together and something came forward. People gave on one side, gave on another side, and we were able to cobble together this format, and just we kept our fingers crossed, and we hoped people would come, and people come. And that's a pretty neat thing. And they've been coming for 2 years. And that's also a very neat thing. And we're, I don't mind saying it, we're a pretty tight-knit group. We're a small, which is a very small fellowship, a very small group. We rotate through commitments back and forth because there's not that many of us. We have strong women in this group, which we don't see in a lot of AA meetings. And we have strong women who can take people through this work, which I think is a wonderful thing. I'm thrilled to be up here and give the two-year report, you know, the State of the Union or the State of the State of the Vision for your group. Nobody got killed. And we made it this far, and it would be really neat if I could stand up here next year and do the same thing. And maybe I'll be a little bit more prepared, but they just nailed me in a parking lot and asked me to say a few words. But thanks so much for coming. Going to have a great speaker tonight. If I wasn't here for this, I'd be here to hear Chris speak, and it's going to be a great night. We have some cake, and we'd encourage you to stay afterwards and meet some group members and just get to know each other a little bit better. But thank you all for coming. And Sharon, you want to take over?
Good evening, everybody. My name is Chris. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much for asking me to come up and do this. It's quite an honor to speak at a group anniversary. This group certainly is one of the pockets of enthusiasm in the North Jersey area. And I thank God for the meetings where you can actually be exposed to the recovery process and the solution to the problem of alcoholism. Unfortunately, in AA today, you can go to groups and really not be directly exposed to your solution. Like I say, my name is Chris. I am an alcoholic. I'm a page 21. What about the real alcoholic? You want to see my description? It's right in there. I do pathetic, tragic things. I build up a bright outlook for my family and tear it down in a senseless series of sprees. I am Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. You know what I mean? That's me. You start putting alcohol in me, and anything can happen. On or around December 28th, 1989. The grace of God separated me from alcohol, and a period of continuous sobriety started. But let me tell you a little bit about my experience and my drinking, about what it was like. For me, I never really felt comfortable with myself. I never really felt comfortable with my environment, even as a little kid. I tell the story of being dropped off at kindergarten, and it's my first memory of fear of people that I can remember. And I remember being dropped off, and there was a hill, and there was the kindergarten classroom, and it was just before it started. And there were kids outside, and they were running around. They were playing kickball and playing tag, and it looked like they had been friends forever. It looked like they'd already integrated, and they had teams and everything. And I was standing up there on that hill looking like, there's no way. I can't do this. You know, what's going to happen if? What if they don't like me? You know, what if I do something stupid? I had like 1,000 fears. And from that moment, I began to act as if. It's like, you know, there's so many slogans and so many little cute sayings, little one-liners that I heard when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought I was different because I was not being helped by these. And one of them was, well, Chris, if you're not feeling really good, just act as if you're feeling good. And I'm like, well, that's what I was doing my whole life. That's the problem. I'm acting as if everything's okay. Everything is not okay. And so I started my I started out in my life being afraid of people, having that self-centered fear, having that anxiety, having the sense of shame and a lot of other things that that kind of deteriorate your emotional condition. And I went through school, and I was always trying to act cool, or, you know, trying not to do something stupid, or always judging situations like, you know, what could I say? I don't want to say this. I don't want to say that. I was like really uptight. But you wouldn't have known it. I mean, I gave the regular war cry. You know, Chris, how's everything going? Great. You know, how you doing? Fine. I mean, that's what I knew that I had to say. I couldn't tell him, well, I'm, you know, suffering from real self-centered fear and terror, and I'm really anxious about social situations, and, you know, contemplating suicide and thinking that, you know, I'm on the wrong planet. How are you doing? You can't say that. You know what I mean? They look at you funny when you do that. So I'd always say, fine. And I moved through school. There was probably a defining event in my life. I remember one day waking up and seeing my father walk out the door. And for some crazy reason, I said to myself that morning, Daddy, don't die today. I just had a premonition. I had a real weird feeling. And my mother, I came home from school. My mother was about an hour behind me. She had a job at that time. And some real weird people came to the door. I mean, they were dressed in black. They were like sinister-looking dudes. And I was there with a couple of my friends, and we said, you know, who are those people? You know, they look like they're from a funeral parlor or something, you know? And my mother came home. She got a phone call. She broke down. She walked into the room, and she told me that my father had died that day at work. And I'm like, you know, I really couldn't. It took me about 3 days to really understand it and internalize it. I had just turned 12. I was 3 days into my 12th birthday. And That was a turning point in my life, because a few months after that, maybe 6 months after that, I had my first drink. So there was a lot of turmoil going on. My mother really couldn't be a disciplinarian to me. She just didn't have what it took to beat me down. Here I am, like a pre-alcoholic, you know, with all the ego and the self-centered, you know, movement. So she really couldn't handle me too much. But anyway, I decided this one day that me and a couple of my buddies, I talked them into cutting school and going to my house and getting drunk. You know, here we are, we're like 12 and a half year olds or something. Never been drunk before, but it'll be cool to do. And we go back and brag about it at school the next day. So we do that, we cut school. And I remember going into the closet and taking down a bottle of Four Roses whiskey. And there wasn't a lot. There's some recognition here, identification with the that wonderful Canadian whiskey, right? Especially the way I drank it this time. I didn't know anything about drinking. I knew from John Wayne movies that there wasn't a lot of drinking going on in my house. I had to blow the dust off of this Four Roses whiskey bottle. It was probably a gift from somebody, you know. Let me tell you, when I was drinking, there was no dust on any of my bottles. But blew the dust off of this and poured out big whiskey glasses because the only drinking I knew was what I saw in the John Wayne movies, where John Wayne would walk in, he'd bust through the saloon doors, and he'd go, "Bartender, whiskey!" And the bartender would pour a big water glass of whiskey, and John would just shoot it down like it was water. Then he'd grab the bottle and go back to the table to play cards and shoot somebody, you know what I mean? And I just thought that that's the way we'll do it. So I pulled the big water glasses of warm Four Roses whiskey. I got to tell you, you know, if you're planning on going back out, that's not how you drink Four Roses whiskey, okay? You got to at least mix it, put it on ice, let it breathe. Here's what happened. Anyway, the two guys I was drinking with had what I guess would be a normal reaction. They drank about two-thirds of their glass and they'd had enough. You ever drink with those kind of people? By mistake? You know what I mean? They'll slip into the bar by mistake and sit next to you and, you know, you want to keep drinking and it's like, nope, got to go home to the little wifey. What? Are you nuts? Let's go to the city! You know, it's Tuesday night. The bar's closed at 5 in the morning. Let's go. But these guys had had enough, and they just sat back. They'd had their drink, and now it was time for the show. And I just, because I started, I drank all of my glass, what they had left in theirs, and most of the rest of the bottle. Here I am, a 12-year-old. I probably had a pint and a half of Four Roses whiskey. And I just, you know, I reacted the way you react when you're that old and you drink that much whiskey. I got crazy. I trashed the house. Got nuts. Went into a blackout. It was my first experience with a blackout. Aren't they fun? Anybody in here have blackouts? Like lost time? You have to like pretend you know what happened. You'll wake up in Topeka with one shoe, and you have to pretend you wanted to be there. You know what I mean? Or stuff like that. So anyway. I went to a blackout. I came to in a field. Everybody had gone home, and I was passed out in the field. And I staggered back to my house, and I had a nuclear hangover. What was really significant about this was I was horribly ill. This stuff, you're first drunk, you vomit until there's, you're vomiting up food that you didn't even eat. You know, I mean, you're so sick, and you just go on and on and on. You know, where'd that carrot come from? You know, type of vomiting. I don't eat carrots, but anyway, I was so sick, and for 2 days I had to remain horizontal. I just, you know, I couldn't pick my head up. I was out. I later learned to control those kind of hangovers with Quaaludes and, you know, Valium and things like that. But I can't talk too much about that, right, Bill? Anyway, so here I am. I am sick, and I got to tell you, if I would have put anything else in my body and got that sick, I'd have stayed away from it. You know, if it was like a fish allergy, or you know, I had too many walnuts or something, I would never go back to that stuff. But what was really significant about this event was, you know, that scared kindergartner that I was telling you about, that emotionally uncomfortable individual, like I was always on edge and just, you know, irritable and discontent and scared and resentful. And I had it all. When that alcohol started going through my bloodstream after about the first glass, all of a sudden I woke up. My spirit woke up. All of a sudden I was like, you know that feeling that you get after like, you know, 6 or 7 shots? I mean, where all your problems just melt away. And you're larger than life, and there's no fear, and you can step out easy. You know what I'm saying? That happened to me. And there was everything that I was looking for to feel good about myself in that bottle. My alcoholism was the scared kindergartner. The solution to my alcoholism was the Four Roses whiskey. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because that relieved me of all these anxieties. There was dancing lessons in this Four Roses whiskey. You know what I'm saying? I never danced. I remember one of these traumatic things. I can't believe that they did this to kids. They probably made therapists all over the country rich. But they used to have barn dances in gym class. And they'd line the women up on one side of the gym and the men on the other, and they'd say, okay, men, run over and grab your partner. And you'd have to run across the gym floor and grab a woman to dance with you. It was like, you know, without any booze in me, you know what I mean? I mean, I was always terrified of asking girls out or, you know, trying to pick them up in the bar until I had like 9 drinks. And then it's like, oh, you don't want to go out with me? Well, you know, don't be begging me later. You know what I mean? I mean, the alcohol had just changed the way I thought about everything. So this woke me up, this alcohol. And from that moment, I started to become preoccupied with alcohol and how I could use it. I realized that warm Four Roses whiskey was something that I have to keep off of the menu. But I knew that there was other forms of alcohol out there. And I started with some Boone's Farm apple wine and some Budweiser beer. You know, the stuff that you get when you're 12 and the drinking age is 21, you know. And so anyway, I started drinking on weekends, started planning it, started hanging out with other people that are going to drink. And you know, this was imperceptible to me. I didn't realize that I was molding my life around alcohol at a very young age. I didn't realize that in itself was starting to deteriorate my quality of life and my academics and you know, the types of people that I hung out. Yeah, I didn't think about it. It was just something that happened automatically to me. It was like a good tool that I had found. And I continued to keep picking it up because for a long time it worked very well. My early years of drinking, sure, there was some problems, but it was mostly fun. I mean, I just remember having a blast. I'd do something stupid and feel bad about it the next day, or I'd crash a car. I crashed a lot of cars. I totaled 9 cars in drunken blackouts. You know, and I never crashed a car while I was awake, so I didn't see it as a problem, you know. And I come from a time when friends let friends drive drunk. I mean, you know, these new policies that they have weren't in effect back in the early 70s. It was, you know, walk to the party, get really drunk, and go home and get the car kind of thing, you know. And designated morons we had, but we didn't have any designated drivers. But anyway, so here I am. I'm preoccupied. Now, the book Alcoholics Anonymous says that we cross a line into obsession. And most of the time, if not all of the time, the alcoholic crosses that line before they seriously want to do something about their drinking. So by the time they've crossed the line with their own unaided will, they can't go back. They can't separate from alcohol. I don't know where that line was crossed, but it went from preoccupation to obsession. Somewhere, I think, around high school, you know, maybe my senior year in high school. But I didn't try to stop drinking, until I was almost 30. And by the time I tried to stop drinking, there was no way. There was no way. I would mysteriously change my mind. Have you ever done that? You ever sworn off booze? I am never touching that stuff again. I can't believe it. I got another DWI, or, you know, I was playing grab ass with the boss's wife at the Christmas party. Oh, my God. You know, I'm never, ever touching that stuff again. And somewhere along the line, you forget and change your mind. You know, I see that today as a manifestation of the obsession of the mind, because it's a sane, rational, logical position to take to not drink when things that happen to us happen to you. You know, I mean, the milkman knows you shouldn't drink by the time we get near AA. But anyway, so I start drinking, and you know, there's a lot of crazy things that went on in the early days. I was doing my drinking in the early 70s, and there was a lot of non-conference approved substances out there that, you know, were available. But I have to tell you that I used them to promote my alcoholic drinking. I would either use the repressants, the downers and things like that for hangover maintenance, and I would use the uppers like cocaine and speed to drink like 6 days straight. You know, I mean, that's really what they were there for. Because because that alcohol feeling is something that it became automatic, and it became an obsession. It became an inner motivation that I didn't even try to fight to be drunk as much as I could be. I met somebody in high school who liked me, which was one of the things that was necessary for me to actually date people. You know, she liked me, and that was enough for me. And I found out later that the reason she was really attracted to me and really liked me is she came from a really alcoholic family. Both her mother and father were alcoholics, and all of her brothers were alcoholic, and all of her sisters are screaming untreated Al-Anons. You know, so meeting up with me was like coming home. You know, we both were in love with the same person. You know what I mean? And we both thought about one guy all day long, and that really worked for me. You know, she would be right there to like pick up the pieces, or you know, go to the impound lot to get the car, you know, pay the bail. I mean, she was there for all that stuff, and it worked for a while. I moved down to Florida to go to college because what I had done after high school was I took a year off, you know, to kind of, not to find myself because I wasn't really looking for anything, basically to have like an uninterrupted time where I could party without having to manage it. So, but what had happened was, you know, the high school parties and the social part of my drinking started to diminish because, you know, my classmates had gone off to college or they had gotten jobs, and I'm still looking for the parties, and the kids are getting younger and younger, and it's just not cool to like do that, to like show up at these parties with, you know, kids that are 20 years younger than you. You know what I mean? So I decided I've got to do something. I'm going to go to college. So I called up my best drinking buddy, who I know went to college. I go, I'm thinking about college. What's it like down there? This was the University of South Florida. He goes, dude, man, there's bars in every building. You know, you have beers before class, and there's every drug in the world, and they're discounted because they come off the boat down here. And the next day, my transcript was in the mail. You know, I mean, I didn't even know what kind of college this was. Could have been a nursing college for all I knew. But I'm going. So I'm on my way, and I go down there, and I spent 3.5 years getting 6 credits. Is that beautiful? Is that beautiful? That's like Doonesbury-esque, isn't it? You know, like Zonker. What would happen was I was a great starter. I would I'd load up. I'd have like 15 credits, you know, business law, economics 3, statistics, and I'd throw in an appreciation of music or a swimming or something. Well, I'd start to go to class, and I'd start to realize, my God, they want me to do all this homework. They, you know, there's tests. I can't deal. And I'd start dropping the courses, and I'd end up going from 15 credits to like 3. I remember this one class, one of the last classes I had, it was appreciation of music. And you'd go into an auditorium, you'd sign in, you'd go into an auditorium, and you'd listen to the professor play like a Beethoven sonata or something on the piano. All you had to do was go there and listen to this guy play, and you got 2 or 3 credits. For the semester. I remember I'd go in there with a little cooler, and in the middle of like some slow, impassioned measure, you'd hear, you know, and everybody like look around, and it'd be me with my Budweisers, you know what I mean? I was like so academically inept, you know, and but anyway, the woman that I had hooked up with at that time, my codependent, came down to Florida, and in a drunken blackout, I guess I proposed to her. This is what she tells me anyway. But I came to the next day, and the invitations were being printed. She goes, oh, isn't that wonderful? I'm like, what? What are you talking about? Now, I'm so alcoholic, right? I mean, it would have been such a scene to back out. So I'm not backing out. I'm playing along. It's 6 months away. You know what I mean? Well, it got harder and harder to do anything about it. So here I am walking down the aisle, you know, and I've got to tell you, this is honest to God's truth. I remember, you know, it's really difficult for me to be sober at this point in time. I am strung, sober. Like, especially put me walking down the aisle with people taking pictures of me and stuff. I mean, I am dying for a drink. So we're the first people to get to the reception. And I walk up to the bartender and I go, "Bartender, give me a bottle of scotch." And he goes, "Who are you?" I go, "I'm the groom." And he goes, "Oh, okay." And he hands me a bottle of scotch. And I just start chugging out of this bottle. And my brand new wife is looking at me like, "Oh, no. Oh, no." You know, she knows exactly what's going to happen. I mean, within minutes, I'm unbelievably drunk. And her parents didn't let us have everybody we wanted to the wedding. So we had arranged to have a party after the reception at my best man's house. So I show up over there. And this party lasted like 2 days. I lasted like 2 minutes. But the worst part was the only person that didn't get like a sexual attack was my wife. I mean, I went after all the women and it just complete blackout. I totally humiliated her. And then I passed out. So the whole party, they've got flowers on me. They've got me laying on a couch, you know, posed like I'm dead. And all the pictures are of me looking dead at this. I mean, you know, this is really pathetic. I mean, you know, we can look back on this and laugh. But I've got to tell you, this is not how you live a life. Some of us can pull it off because we've got cool kind of cool personalities, or you know we learn how to just push it out of the back. But you know this gets to you after 20 years of drinking like this. You know our esteem and our self-worth and everything is just shot. And finally, by the time I got sober, I'll tell you how I got sober. I became an electrician. You know, I lost that wife and I had a daughter, and you know they moved three or four times to get away from me, and you know I wasn't really able to get good jobs or anything because I mean I couldn't do anything by this time seriously because of my drinking. But I became an electrician. Now, what kind of a trade is that for somebody that drinks like I do? I mean, I'm always blowing stuff up all the time. I mean, you know, I would drill down into somebody's closet and pull one of their suits up into the attic with the drill bit, you know. And another time I wired a kitchen addition to the wrong panel, and it was a timer panel for the hot water heater. So the kitchen would come on at 8 o'clock at night and go off at 6 in the morning, old kitchen. It'd go, boom, it's on, you know, at 8 o'clock at night. I remember they called my boss and said, "Listen, we eat at 6. This is unacceptable. You've got to do something." Another time, I swear to God, this is true. I was an electrician for Epstein's, which was like a Macy's or something. It was like a big department store. And this was when the computer cash registers were just coming in. And I had the daisy chain computer wire to every single one of these new cash registers back to the computer system. It's like 1984 or something. So what I'd have to do is I'd have to drill down through the floor and then kind of climb up into the ceiling and find these wires and drag. It was a hassle. It'd take me about 6 hours per cash register. But this one time I'm in the lingerie section of Epstein's, and I've got this big, huge, half a horsepower locking trigger, big metal drill, you know, with the handles sticking out, with an auger bit with an extension. And I'm drilling, and, you know, there's things to look at when you're in the lingerie section, so I'm not really paying a lot of attention. And all of a sudden, the drill bit hits a nail and it catches. And the trigger is accidentally locked. So all of a sudden, the drill starts taking off and I bear down on it. I don't want to, like, let it go. And it starts twisting me around like this. And it ties me up in the cord and rips the pants off my ass. And it finally stops when it unplugs from the wall because the cord is, you know, being tied up around me. And I'm tied to a drill with no pants going back and forth like this in the lingerie section of Epstein's. Now, you know, you got to act cool when something like that happens, you know. Like, "Oh, yeah, this always happens with this drill." You know? I mean, you have to. But these kind of things are always happening to me. And, I mean, I had a boss who put a 19-year-old kid in charge of me finally. And I mean, I was 32, and, you know, Junior was my boss. "Well, what do you want me to do now, Junior?" I mean, it was humiliating. But this one time, here was the straw that broke the camel's back. Total 9 cars, 3 DWIs. This was my 11th job in like 10 years. My wife and family had left me. I'm living in a room at my mother's, you know, no money in the bank, terrible job, terrible people I'm working with, just as pathetic as can be. And I've got a screwdriver and a ground screw, and I'm trying to put a ground screw in a light fixture box. And I drank quite a bit the night before, maybe a little bit more than usual. And, you know, I'm in kind of DTs and a little bit, and I'm shaking. And the screw keeps coming off the end of the screwdriver, and I can't do it. And Junior is standing at the bottom of the ladder looking up at me. And, you know, when you're alcoholic and you're detoxing, you can hear people think at you. You know what they're thinking. And he was thinking, you pathetic. No good, lazy, no account, you know, and I just couldn't take that. I couldn't take that. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. And that night, I had been exposed to an outpatient rehab to get my license back for like DWI-2. So I knew where to go, and I called this place up, and I go, I'm coming in. And it was a 28-day treatment center, and I went in. I signed myself in, and in I went. I don't remember much of this experience. I remember a few highlights. I remember sitting around in group. Anybody ever go to rehab and sit around in group? Was that 10 times? Okay, yeah, that's a special time for me, sitting around in group, listening to people share about their bizarre sociopathic crap, you know, as it's going around the circle, and I'm just thinking to myself, shut up, I want to talk. I want to talk about my sociopathical crap. Why don't you just drink? Why don't you leave? Why don't you go AWA? I mean, you know, I was like Mr. Unity at that point in time, you know, Mr. Fellowship. I hated everybody. I remember that. I remember wallet making class, which was special. I remember not getting the stitches quite right. What the hell does making a wallet have to do with recovery from alcoholism? I still don't understand that. I've been volunteering at rehabs now for 17 years, and I still don't know what wallet making has to do with recovery from alcoholism. But there's got to be something. There's got to be some reason. Anyway, I remember that. I remember some of the funny stories, but I don't remember. I remember them giving me the book Alcoholics Anonymous and giving me the book 12 Steps and 12 Traditions, giving them to me here. If you got some spare time, read it. And I was a reader back then, mostly science fiction, things that take you away from this planet, was the things, you know, like get me out of me, you know, type of movies, get me out of me type of literature, get me out of me type of music. You know, whatever. I didn't want to be here now. That's the only thing I didn't want to be. So I was a reader. I picked up the book Alcoholics Anonymous and I read it through like it was the Da Vinci Code. You know what I mean? Just went through it. And I remember that there was some identification. I would say, ooh, yeah, I do that. But mostly there was, oh, that son of a bitch, that's my roommate, does that. It was more like I could see defects of character in you. It was very, very difficult for me to see the defects of character in me. I believe that there are people that can get sober by, you know, sending them a big book. You know, there are lighthouse keepers in Bangladesh or something. And, you know, you send them a big book and they can get sober. But I'll tell you what, I needed a little more on the nurturing side than that, because I read this thing and it sounded to me like something written in 1935 by a couple of real well-meaning people. And there was some principles in there that I, you know, I kind of admired, but I thought that, you know, whatever the big book is, man, I need the master class, you know. I need something more than whatever this is talking about. And there wasn't anybody in that rehab that was pointing me toward recovery. They were trying to arm me with facts about alcoholism. They were trying to teach me about my triggers, and there was relapse prevention class, and there was a lot of crazy things like that were going on that are okay unless you're in real trouble. If you're in real trouble, trying to treat alcoholism with remembering your triggers is just not going to be sufficient. For an alcoholic like me, human power is going to be of no avail. self-knowledge is going to be of no avail. And I found that to be the case. I got out of rehab. I got the $12,000 big book and the pat on the butt to AA, as a lot of us get. And I went to AA. I went to two AA meetings a week, and I went to two outpatient meetings. They told me to go to outpatient, so I went to the outpatient meetings. And I went to two AA meetings. I'm going four nights a week. What do you people want from me? You know, I mean, how much more of this sobriety stuff do I need to do? And I was actually paying $65 a night to hear muttonheads go around the circle in group. I was going to a couple of AA meetings where they were really just discussion meetings where people were kind of encouraged to talk about their day, about what was happening, you know, what's going on in your life. Oh, well, Aunt Fanny and Uncle Fudd are getting a divorce, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to go on vacation, and all this garbage. And I remember sitting in these meetings going, I'm in real trouble. I know I'm in real trouble. I don't get what being here is going to do for my sobriety. What is sitting and listening to everybody talk about their problems, what is that going to do to keep me sober? And I started to think that maybe AA was like a twisted pep rally or something, where, you know, yay, we don't drink today. And, you know, like some kind of football huddle where, you know, you get together every night and, you know, let's keep it simple. It's first things first. You know, don't take the first drink. Okay, break. And, you know, see you back here tomorrow. So, okay, I'm coming, you know, but you're all nuts. And I'm going to AA and I'm going to outpatient. And I am serious. I want to separate from alcohol. Let me tell you what. There wasn't a person in any of those meetings or any of those outpatients that wanted to not drink more than me. I wanted separation from that poison. That stuff was making me crazy. I'd try to kill people when I drank it. That'll get your attention. You know, when you answer the door with a handgun, it's a Girl Scout selling cookies or something, you know? I mean, I was out of my mind. And I was moments away from doing something that would put you in the penitentiary for 20 years. I knew that. So, I mean, I wanted to separate from alcohol in the worst way. And here's how the obsession of the mind worked with me. It can't get through to me. It can't really get through to me normally, because I really have that desire not to drink. But it doesn't matter. The desire not to drink is insufficient. Here's how the obsession manifested in me. I'm driving to an AA meeting, for God's sake, and the thought crosses my mind, you know, I've been sober for almost 90 days. As a matter of fact, I don't even really remember what it's like to be drunk, that drunk feeling. It's been so long, I don't even really remember it. And the AA stuff, I know I should be doing a little bit better at it. I know I should be participating a little bit more. I know what I'll do. I'll buy a gallon of vodka. I'll take it back to my house. I'll drink that gallon of vodka, and it'll solve these problems. Number one, I'll remember what it's like to be drunk. And number two, it'll make me feel so bad, I'll zoom back to AA, and I'll just, you know, I'll be Mr. AA. This is good. This is going to work. So I buy the gallon of vodka. This is why you have sponsors, by the way. This is why you tell your plan to your sponsor. This is why sponsors want to hear your plan. You know what I mean? Before you do anything, let me hear your plan. Me and my buddies collect and trade newcomer plants. Some of them are beauts. Anyway, I did that. I went home. I drank probably half of that gallon of vodka. And here's what happened when I was drinking. It's all a good idea. It's all a good idea. I'm into my third drink, and all of a sudden I go, oh, my God, what have I done? I'm drinking again. I've opened up the cage door to the beast. I'm going to be dragged around by my hair for I don't know how long, and I don't know what's going to happen. I don't know. I have no idea what's going to go on. I'm stuck now in active alcoholism. How am I going to get separated again? Now, think about this. Did the alcohol make me insane, or did it give me sanity? It actually brought sanity into my life, because the insane thought was that I could buy a gallon of vodka and drink it. The sanity came in drink number three when I recognized the enormity of my mistake. But it was too late by then, because then you have the allergy of the body, which is that compulsion, that physical compulsion that you must continue to drink until you're tongue-chewing, knee-walking, zipper malfunctioning, sleeping in the neighbor's bushes drunk. You know what I mean? I used to do that all the time. You know, I was embarrassed about being in AA in the first 6 months. And somebody said, yeah, Chris, your neighbors are just going to have to figure out why you're not parking on their lawns anymore. You know, don't tell them. So here I am. I'm drunk. I go through another 5 months of active alcoholism, the worst 5 months, let me tell you. The worst possible thing for your drinking is to quit for a period of time. Because I'll tell you, they say you go back like you never stopped. I think it's even worse than that. I think that when you allow your liver and pancreas to be away from alcohol for a period of time, they get worse, way worse. Because when I went back, I didn't go back to where I was when I left off. I went back, I was way worse than I had ever been, almost immediately. And it was tragic. Christmas at the Schroeders, 1989. Everybody's there. I'm still living at my mother's. My mother's there, brothers, sisters, nieces, nephews, pets, the whole thing. And the stockings were hung by the chimney with care. And, you know, the Christmas tree was up and there was presents. And they were going to go up carol singing and, you know, the whole thing. And I start drinking my holiday drink, which is Johnny Walker Black, you know. And I start drinking that and I go into a violent, insane blackout where I threaten all their lives. I start trashing the house, and you know that's not really the festive mood they were all looking for. So they picked up and they moved, and they moved their Christmas to my sister's house in upstate New York. And I came to, and there was a pile of vodka bottles in the sink that I didn't remember buying. It was bizarre. I was looking at about 20 bottles that I didn't remember buying. I'd been on like a 3 or 4 day blackout continuously. And I started to detox. I had found out through making phone calls, where is everybody? I tracked them down. I found out what happened. And I was at that jumping off place. I was at that place where you can no longer even consider not having alcohol, and you can't consider continuing to drink it. And you wish for the end. It's that job. And I did. I cried out to a God that I had rejected for many, many years, probably since my father had died. And I said, God, please either kill me or let me get sober. I can't live like this one more minute. And this is a prayer I'm saying while I'm detoxing. I'm telling you, I went into hallucinations and convulsions. There were animals on the outside scratching to get in. There were little animals running around. There was maggots on the slipcovers. You know, there was bands playing. I mean, it was nuts. Anybody that's ever gone into the DTs knows what I mean. And I remember lying back on the couch in one position. I was almost comfortable enough to be able to tolerate it. And I remember a demon coming out of the ceiling, like one of those big monitor ones. They look like a bull, you know, come, wah, and it's coming down to eat my face. And I remember going, ah, just like, it was horrible. Anybody in their right mind would have been in the hospital, because they would have Libriumed you up and you would have been fine. You know what I mean? And I knew that. You know why I didn't do it? Because I would have looked bad driving away in an ambulance. I mean, how alcoholic is that? I may die, but I'm not going to look bad. You know what I mean? So I went through 3 days of this horrific detox, and I knew I needed to get back to AA. So I had a car by this time, and you know how if you're alcoholic, you have the $100 varieties of cars? I had a 1976 Ford Granada with white walls. It had all the quarter panels were destroyed. It had no clutch, barely any clutch. No emergency brake. It had no heater core, so if you turned on the heat, it would spray antifreeze on the inside of the window. The muffler was gone. I mean, this was a real piece of work, this car. It was a 4-speed Granada. Can you imagine? Anyway, white interior, which was covered with orange paint from, like, some blackout. Like, a gallon of orange paint was, like thrown all around the interior of this car, and it didn't matter. I didn't care. You don't have time to fix cars when you drink the way I was drinking. It's a full-time job to drink the way I'm drinking. You're busy. You can't take the car in to be fixed. So I had this Quaalude car. And I knew that I had to get to a meeting, so I had to get to a meeting that was flat because there was no clutch. So I looked in the meeting book. I had a meeting book, and I found a flat meeting, and it was in Morristown. And I got there. Now you got to picture this. This car was a piece of work. I get to the Church of the Redeemer, to Sunday night 6 o'clock meeting, and you drive down South Street or whatever, and then you have to turn in to the driveway, and there's a little uphill that goes right past the porch where everybody is smoking. That's back when everybody smoked. You know, not everybody smokes anymore, but everybody smoked back then. Anyway, I got to drive by all of my peers, and because it's an uphill, I've got to gun this thing because there's no clutch and there's no muffler. So I go right by all of my new peers like this, at about a mile and a half an hour, and everybody just looks down like, you know, must be a new guy. And I had to, literally, I had to park it up against a tree because it wasn't a level parking lot and no emergency brake, no clutch, it would have rolled. So I parked it against a tree kind of downhill and nobody parked next to me. It was like a full lot. Nobody parked next to me that night. But anyway, and I go in. And now, I got to tell you, I am shattered and I am scared. Terror. I mean, not just scared, terror. And I walk in and there's the fluorescent lights and I sit down. And somebody hands me a step book, and it's a 12-step meeting. And, you know, I can't really realize things quickly, but I look over, and I notice that it's in our row. Each person is reading a paragraph or two, and it's coming toward me. You know what I mean? Oh, my God. I thought, you know, I can't even hold this book, let alone read. So I panic. And I get up and I go outside and I'm standing on the porch and I'm out there having a cigarette. And it's one of those, you know, Norm Alpie used to talk a lot. He was one of the great speakers and he used to talk about seconds and inches. And it was seconds and inches. I was at a point where I was really considering, I can't do this. This is just, it's asking too much of me. I don't have the fortitude to do this AA thing. I am not going to make it. You know, I'm going to go home. I'll probably stay away from booze for a couple of days, but I'm done. I'm done. I'm not going to make it. And this guy, Jorge, comes out and grabs me. And he says, you know, so what's your deal? And I say something like, well, you're relapsing, drinking, demons, terrible. And he goes, listen, come on back inside and finish the meeting off with me. I'm like, well, it's a meeting tomorrow, the beginner's meeting. You know, I'm going to go there tomorrow. And he knew. I found out later the guy had like 12 days or something. But he was smart enough to know that what tomorrow meant. He said, no, you're coming in. And I didn't want to make a scene, so I went in with him. And the two seats next to each other were in the second row, so I sat down right in the second row. I'm sitting there. And by now, people are sharing. I'm sitting there like just out of my mind. And he looks over him and he goes, raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back. And I go, well, there's a meeting tomorrow. You know, it's not appropriate tonight. There's a meeting tomorrow. There's a beginning. Everybody raises their hand. Everybody's coming back. And he looks at me and he goes, raise your hand. He's starting to get loud now. Raise your hand and tell everybody you're coming back. So, you know, people are starting to look at me now. You know what I mean? You know how that is. You know what? People looking at you. They'll be thinking at you pretty soon. So I knew I had to do something. I got to do something. So, right in the middle of this woman sharing, I throw up my hand. I'm going to raise my hand, tell her. And the leader of the meeting like looks at me and just sees me and shuts the person up who's talking so that they can call on me. I've been in 4,000 AA meetings. I've never seen that. But that's what happened. The person was shut up and I was called on. And I said something like, oh, Chris, I was drinking, I was demons, or the maggots on his lip, I was horrible, the eyes are coming back, thank you. And there's quiet, because everybody's, you know, kind of assimilating this. And then all of a sudden there was, yay! And they all start just clapping and cheering. It was like one of those Morristown meetings. You know what they were like back then. And they were off the chain, those meetings. And I mean, I could just picture what they were thinking. You are so pathetic. I can't believe how lame you are. I can't even believe how sick you are. Man, I came in here with problems. And, you know, you made me feel great. Thank you, you know. But, man, I thought I had problems. But But anyway, here's what happened. After raising my hand and actually talking in a meeting and telling people I was coming back, I knew I had turned a corner. I'd gone over the hump. If I could do that, I knew it was all downhill and I might survive alcoholism. So what happened was I went back to the beginner's meeting the next night and I got a sponsor. He had been my contact in rehab. And when an ex-girlfriend was sending the Hell's Angels over to kill me, I remember using him as a contact. Oh, listen, I got this problem. And I just talked to him the other day. He's still doing really well. He's got like 26 years. He goes, Chris, when you called me up with that problem, that was not in the sponsorship book. You know, the Hell's Angels coming over to get you. I had to improvise on that one. But anyway, it was, you know, it ended up being all crap on her part. But, you know, because my last girlfriend, you know, was a Harley Hell Angel woman. And, being from Basking Ridge, being like a white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, you know, didn't work, especially when I moved her in with me and Mom. You know, they did not get along, let me tell you. They saw things differently. But anyway, to get off of that subject, I got this guy and I started using him as a sponsor. Now, you got to understand, AA in the North Jersey area, with very few exceptions, was what I would call oral tradition AA. It was basically like sponsors would pass on wisdom teachings and you would grab things cafeteria style from the meetings and the sharing and you would attempt to put some kind of a personal program together. I mean, that's really what was going on back then. And I had a good sponsor, so I was able to stay sober a year and a half until I discovered recovery, thank God. But a lot of people weren't so lucky back then. A lot of people that were page 21 alcoholics were dead. That's what would happen to you coming into AA in North Jersey back in the late 80s. You were dead. You weren't going to make it. So because there was no answer. There was fellowship. There was not recovery. There was unity. There wasn't any steps, really. There was a lot of step meetings. And you would go to a step meeting, and you would hear people talk about the steps, philosophize about the steps, read about the steps, share about the steps, think about the steps, talk about what the steps might be like if you actually did them. You know, but there was very, very few people that would share their experience on the steps. This is just, you know, what the 12 and 12 did when it hit the market. It kind of pushed the big book aside for people working programs, which I never understood, but it did, especially in our area. So anyway, I am staying sober by going to a lot of meetings, being meeting dependent. I'm going to anywhere from 7 to 13 meetings a week, and I'm driving people that don't have any money. I'm taking them out to friendlies and buying them supper, and you know, I'm driving people to meetings. I'm a secretary over here, and I mean, I was saying yes to AA. You know what I mean? When AA was asking me, I was saying yes. And that's probably the only reason why I was able to stay sober for a year and a half. But, you know, that scared kindergartner that I was talking about, he was all over me the first year and a half. I was, to raise my hand and share in a meeting was hard. I was all worried about, well, what am I going to say? If I say something stupid, will I have to beat the guy up after the meeting? You know, and I'll tell you what, if I beat the guy up after the meeting, that means I'll have to change home groups. I'll tell you what, I better not share. I mean, you know, this is the type of stuff that was going through my head, you know? And I also got a lot of resentments. Anybody in here ever get resentments about people in your meetings? People in your loving fellowship? You know, your brothers and sisters in recovery? If that son of a bitch shares again, I don't know what I'm going to do. That hypocritical bastard, he talks about serenity, he goes, he yells at his wife. I mean, you know, I had these... I'm leaving. I mean, and I changed home groups 3 or 4 times in the first couple of years. I mean, I was nuts, okay? I was chirping like a squirrel in the first year and a half. I had no recovery. There's a big difference between sobriety and recovery. Sobriety is just stay away from booze. Punch a cop and you can get sober. But to be okay about it, to be okay about not drinking, I think that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is about, you know? And it takes a lot of work. The requirement membership for AA is to have an honest desire or have a desire to stop drinking. There's a million requirements for recovery. You know, you can get the seat. You can get the seat in the room cheap. Recovery doesn't come cheap. And I learned that because a friend of mine, Radio Shack Mike, listened to tapes. Everybody had nicknames back then. There was Bummed Out Bob, you know, Fish Food Phil, Evangelical Andy. And during an inventory, I realized why they all had nicknames. It was because I was nicknaming them, you know, Mr. Recovery. But Bummed Out Bob really took it hard, too, when he found out, you know, what people were calling him. Anyway, well, he was. He'd go to meetings and go, oh, my wife's leaving my job. It got tiring after a while, you know. Why don't you just shut up, you know? Bummed Out Bob. So anyway, you know, not that I judged back then. Everyone was a child of God to me, and acceptance, tolerance, and patience was my code. But anyway, this is prior to any exposure to the steps. Anyway, Radio Shack Mike gave me a set of tapes from a couple of guys from Arkansas, which that was a warning flag right there. Arkansas. These tapes are from Arkansas? The hell good ever came out of Arkansas? I'm thinking, no, Arkansas. So, but I had a long ride to work, so I put him in, and I started listening to him. And here's what they told me. They said, Chris, you're a fellowship dude, man. You're fellowshipping like crazy. You have no program. If somebody is not working with you or you're not involved in the instructions and taking the exercises instructions out of the big book as they're laid out, you don't have a program, because that's what a program is. Have you ever heard somebody share, when I came into the program? You ever hear that? When I came into the program, well, how do you go into a big book? Do you hollow out the pages? How do you do that? So everybody was talking about, yeah, my program, and when I came into the program, and I worked my program today, I called my sponsor, I worked my program today, I didn't hit somebody when I wanted to. You know, and this is what they were saying back then. So all of a sudden, Joe and Charlie are telling me that a program is the instructions in the big book. Quite a surprise to me, you know. Wait a minute, these guys are from Arkansas. They're probably wrong. But I've got to tell you, you know, that's not how we do it in New Jersey, you know. And we do more thinking by 9 o'clock in New Jersey than somebody in Arkansas is going to do all day. That's just how I thought back then. It's so funny. The person who should least have a big ego is an alcoholic. And they're the first people to have a big ego. We'll walk into AA after destroying our lives, destroying multiple families, and we'll come into AA and we'll wonder why people aren't following us. You know what I mean? Come on! I mean, it's just bizarre the type of ego we have. Anyway, you know what I think? I really don't care what you think. You still have puke on your shirt. You know, clean up for a little while and we'll talk about what you think. But anyway, anyway, so I'm listening to these tapes, and I got pissed off. I threw them aside. But the message haunted me. You know, there's a place in the book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that says, if we've disturbed you about your alcoholism, this is all to the good. We want to disturb you. It's not my job to help everybody feel comfortable in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, I'm not to be abusive. I'm to try to be loving. But I'm not to try to shield you from the truth. It says we never apologize for depending upon God. And how I take that is I never apologize for working the steps that got me to God. I'm not going to apologize for that. You know what I mean? That's how I found recovery, through these tapes. There was a couple of people that were walking around that had gone through the steps. Certainly Howard, who really could use our prayers right now. Howard was one of them. He would show up at some of the meetings I was at, but I'll be completely honest with you. I was warned away from him. Here comes that guy with the big book. Because he would carry it to meetings. And that was like, you know, people would think it like if you showed up with a Bible kind of thing, you know. Here's the guy with the Bible, you know. They're gonna be preaching all on you now. I mean, that's kind of the way a lot of people reacted to him. So, because I was following the oral tradition at that time, I didn't respond to his message. I did respond to these tapes messages, and all of a sudden, I now knew what Howard was talking about. But I had to find it the way I found it. Anyway, some things happened in my life. One of them was a relationship that I'd gotten into, God's will for me at that point in time, broke up. And that was traumatic for me. I mean, I had really fallen in love with this girl, and you know, she basically said, "See ya," and it was just traumatic for me. And I remember going over to my sponsor's house and just not even being able to talk. I showed up at his door unexpected, knocked on the door, said, "Bill," you know, and he brought me inside, you know, fed me or whatever you know you did as a sponsor back then. But anyway. Later that week, I remember taking out the tapes and putting them in the tape player, opening up the big book, because they had talked about that emotional bondage, being in bondage to alcoholism, being in bondage to your emotional nature, your psychological makeup, having an inability to have any serenity in your life, to just have it, just be incompatible with the universe. And it talked about recovery from that in these tapes. So I go, I'm going to give this a shot. You know, I believe it's a way out. And what I did was I went through the best I could. I had no guidance. I remember bringing a four-column inventory to my sponsor at that time, and he goes, "What the hell are all these columns? Where's your story?" And I said, you know, let me, I was following some tapes. Let me just do this, will you? And he goes, "Sure, fine." And I got through it. And I started to feel better inside. You know, so much of what I was trying to recover from, I thought was outside. I thought was the car crashes and the fights and the people being mad at me and, you know, the bad jobs and all the stuff out there. I thought that to fix all that stuff was recovery from alcoholism. And what these tapes were telling me, no, Chris, it's an inside job. Recovery from alcoholism comes from inside. Problems is in your mind. The problem is in your emotions. The problem is in your feelings and a lot of other things. So as I went through these exercises, I started to feel better about myself. Now, at this time, believe it or not, being as unrecovered as I was sponsoring people by this time. Because if you give enough good share, you know, you give good share, you can get sponsees. And I gave good share. I would try to be just funny enough so nobody would be mad at me in the meeting. You know, I'd be just irreverent enough for people to think that I'm, you know, I'm adorable. I would give like good share, you know, because my self-esteem was all attached to what I was going to say and how I was going to say it and not having anybody upset with me and especially not having anybody come up and correct me after the meeting, for God's sake. You know, I liked what you said, but, you know, you're really wrong about, I mean, you know, you would not want to have done that in my first year and a half. But anyway, I started, these guys that I was sponsoring were drinking on me. You ever work with people and they drink on you? Makes you look bad. People come up and they go, "Hey, is Harry yours? You know, he's drinking and he's borrowing money and he's got Sydney's car and he's causing trouble, you know, and he's trying to hit on all the women. What are you going to do about it?" You ever have that when you look bad, you're being marginalized as a sponsor? So especially these guys that were drinking, I had just gone through the big book as clumsily as you can possibly go through with a set of tapes and a book and a notebook. I started to bring guys over my house and go through the book. I'm telling you, we started on the title page and I read every word through the first 164. I don't do it that way anymore. It's just, I don't have time in my life to do it that way. But that's how I did it back then. And every single time there was an instruction, we wrote down that instruction specifically, and they were sent home with homework with the instructions for that week to do. And I found out something very, very significant. The people that went through this process and didn't run away at step 5 or run away at step 9, every single one of them is still in AA. Not only still in AA, their quality of life is out the roof. They've improved every area of their life. They're AA members in good standing. Their groups can count on them, and they're all working with others. And when I say working with others, what I mean is taking other people through the steps. Taking other people through the steps. And some of the people that I sponsor have started meetings. Four of the guys that I sponsor have started meetings. One guy started a whole new fellowship. You've probably heard about A&A. That's one of my guys, Ray, who really is the principal architect of that. I mean, they're out there and they're working with others and they're carrying the message to the best of their ability, and they're carrying the message to the people that respond most to their message, and they're doing really like me. It had ruined the whole night for me. I mean, I was really attached. Well, somebody's asking me to start an AA meeting where I teach other people out of the big book how to be better AA members and how to recover. Do you understand the significance of that? How people can see that as incredibly arrogant? What I did was 80% of the people that I was friends with in AA were immediately not friends with me after doing that. That cut me out of a lot of stuff and a lot of groups and I got beat up for that. That was not something I would have chosen to do, but because I had gone through the steps, because my spirit was awakened, and because there was like a divine set of circumstances that led up to this, I knew I had to. So, you know, we started the Burnsville group, and it started very small. And Peter and I are involved in a currently over there in a workshop, and there's 120 people showing up there on Tuesday nights. It's absolutely amazing, what has happened. It's become semi-fashionable in some areas in North Jersey AA to not only talk about recovery but to participate in it and to experience it. You know, there's groups like this that promote it. Thank God there are groups like this. You know, we don't need another discussion meeting where people are going to talk about how white their laundry is. You know what I mean? Or the fan belt on the Mercedes letting go. Or the spot on the X-ray. We really don't need more. There's enough of those. There's enough of those. And there's enough speaker meetings where Booker's is involved and you're held hostage by any muttonhead that signs up for the commitment. There's enough of those type of speaking commitments, speakers meetings. We don't need any more. You know, right now the renaissance is swinging toward recovery meetings. There's a website that Bill turned me onto not long ago, and it's actually the Intergroup website for New Jersey, and they'll show flyers for new meetings, new meeting in Bayonne, new meeting in Sea Caucus, new meeting in Weehawken, you know what I mean, and new meeting in Suffern. It's the Suffern Succotash group, you know. I mean, they've got all these, and every single flyer. 3 out of 4 of them are big book related. The meetings that are starting, they're either big book discussion meetings, they're big book workshop meetings, or the big book speaker meetings, big book step meetings. I mean, take a look. There's a renaissance. There's a shift now. And the shift has happened because of meetings like this. It's starting to become fashionable to talk about recovery. Now, what I see that's really good about this is if you're a page 21 alcoholic, you need some time to be exposed. I don't know how long you can last in fellowship alone and a little bit of service. I don't know. Each of us has our own grace periods, and some of them are very short. Some of them can go on 20 years, but some of them are very short. So you're in that grace period until you hit the recovery process. So at least if you're a page 21 alcoholic, there's going to be more chances for you to stumble on a group like this where somebody just say, hey, you know, have you been through the steps? Well, oh, you have it? Well, would you like to go through the steps? Oh, you would? Okay, well, come on over to my house or meet me at the meeting an hour early and we'll get started. You know what I mean? There's areas now where you can, the Berkeley Heights, there's big book meetings all over the place where you can get exposed to this stuff now. And that's a good thing. And, you know, if I sound critical about the oral tradition of the normal AA, don't get me wrong. I'm really, you know, I think that there's a place for everything out there. I really do. But there was no place for the page 21 until groups like Berkeley Heights and Hackettstown and Bernardsville and Union and places like this started up. There really wasn't. The only option you had was to grit your teeth and just try to stay away from booze one day at a time. And how many of us tried that and how cranky were we? You know what I mean? We were not to be trifled with during our period of sobriety. Where am I at with my life today? Talk about amazing promises. I think every single promise in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous at least manifested itself. If it's not currently in place in my life today, I've at least experienced every promise in the book Alcoholics Anonymous because I've done the work multiple times. I'm not always perfect. My spiritual condition is not always right there. I'm human, and being human in word, thought, and deed, I fall short every day. But there's some tools to help help me pull myself up with the aid of God and some other guided people. But I went from being a bad electrician to I'm now a manager of a big piece of business with 60 employees, several million dollars in budget. That I have sole discretionary power over the budget. Let me tell you, you wouldn't have put me in charge of a lemonade stand when I walked into AA. 5 years into AA, you'd still be worried about, you know, the lemons the sugar being embezzled, I'm telling you. That's good. I met a really, really wonderful woman, somebody in AA, you know, boy meets girl on AA campus and trouble soon follows. She shared at a meeting one time that she wanted to buy a town because if she bought a town, she could dress everybody the way she wanted to dress and decorate everything she wanted to decorate it. You know, like she could control that town and it would be the perfect town if she owned it. And I, you know, immediately became attracted to that kind of mentality. You know what I'm saying? And we have a sober house today. We have a house where the phone rings off the wall. The phone rings off the wall. Got a call the other day from this mother saying, my son shaved his, got drunk, he relapsed, he shaved his head, he's got a big meeting tomorrow. I go, well, you know, have him tell the boss that's his new look. Well, he shaved his eyebrows too. You know, and I mean, I get these great phone calls from people constantly working with other people. Everybody in our area, even the non-alcoholics, know to give my wife or I a call. My wife is sponsoring a gazillion women. I'm sponsoring a lot of guys. We travel around. We do speaking commitments here or there. Some of the things coming up, I'm doing a prison workshop in Virginia for some people next month. That's kind of exciting. The best part will be I'll be able to walk out, you know, when it's over with. I'm a music lover, and I'm also obsessive compulsive. So when I got into music, I buy albums and I buy CDs, but you don't know what I'm talking about. I mean, I buy them. I buy 30 a day. I buy more CDs than I can listen to. I mean, because I'm obsessive compulsive. I remember having a music room in the house I was in about 10 years ago where, Bill, did you see the music room over there? The whole master bedroom was wall-to-wall albums and CDs, just wall-to-wall. If I started listening now, I'd be dead before I'd get to the other end of them all. I mean, that's how many I had. But I really, really loved music. And the opportunity presented itself through knowing a lot of people to actually host a television show where we brought in guests, and I was the host, and we bring in musicians, and they put it on a local cable TV channel in North Jersey. And that was fun. Just shot a pilot for this is the second thing I'm involved with, and it hasn't made TV yet, but I'm being assured that it's gonna. It's a pilot for a show called Family Dynamics, and myself and two other people are going to be hosting experts in all different areas of family dynamics. And we're going to be talking about issues that hit contemporary families, not only addictive illnesses, but all kinds of other stuff. And I'm not making money on any of this stuff, really, not even my job. I'm overpaid in every area of my life except my job. But the thing is you know, I never could have imagined my life opening up to the things that are happening to me today. I mean, you know, we're doing Wilson House workshops, and a couple of my buddies were asked to start ANA in Iceland. And when they were driving in the car, there's recovery radio over there. They heard me. I have recovery radio talks that I don't even know about in Iceland. I mean, you know, if you would have told me when I walked in the doors of AA that all of this stuff was going to happen to me, I'd say, you're out of your mind. I can't even raise my hand and share. But the fact of the matter is is the recovery process works. If you're new or just coming back and you have feelings of you feel uncomfortable, it seems like your personal relationships, it seems like you're not getting along with people, that maybe people are picking on you, and you're not being judged by your intentions, you're being judged by your actions, and the cops just seem to always be picking on you, and your boss is an asshole, he doesn't know anything, and you know, you're always uncomfortable. You always want to be somewhere else. You never want to be where you are. You want to be somewhere else. If you're new and you're coming back and you have any of those feelings, understand that very well could be alcoholism. And the solution to alcoholism is the solution to a lot of those feelings and that conscious state of being, that bondage to self that we suffer from. And the recovery process from alcoholism not only allows you to separate from alcohol. If you're newer coming back, that's probably all you want. Let me tell you, it's off the charts, the things that are available in AA. Whatever you put in, you'll get twice as much out of. I want to thank everybody for not walking out on me tonight. That's always a plus. Peter, again, thank you for asking me to come up here. Great job with the second year anniversary. In Burnsville's third and fourth year, the size increased incredibly. If you talk about the steps, you offer the solution, you're not embarrassed to talk about God, they will come. Be ready for it, okay? Thanks a lot for having me.